Our area is home to a host of innovative entrepreneurs. This hour, we meet three of them: saltwater shrimp farmers, a creator of vintage wrapping paper, and a man who prints in three dimensions. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, we listen back to an hour of conversations with unique and innovative Iowa entrepreneurs. We'll visit with Mark Ginsberg of Iowa City. He's using 3D printing to create jewelry and much more. Also, a couple in northwest Iowa who are taking a crack at saltwater shrimp farming. And finally, Kim Brockie, who sells reproductions of vintage wrapping paper. We'll find out how her paper found its way into the movie Ted. That's all coming up after this news. I'm Ben Kiefer with River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Today you're listening to an encore edition of the program.
This hour, we're taking the time to get to know a number of unique and innovative Iowa businesses. For nearly three decades, my next guest, Mark Ginsberg, has been the owner and president of M.C. Ginsberg, Inc. and M.C. Ginsberg Metal Arts Studio. That's located in downtown Iowa City. It's a business with a long tradition, also one that has the knack of staying on the cutting edge of innovation. And I'm actually in the studio with Mark Ginsberg at his studio. Hi, Mark, and welcome to River to River.
Thanks for having me, Ben. Hello.
Well, thank you for inviting us here today because, and we're actually here on site at your studio because you're going to give us a little demonstration of some exciting new technology, namely 3D printing. And during the course of this short conversation, you're going to print something for us in three dimensions, and that is the sound, if we can take a listen, that is the sound we have going on in the background. Let's listen for a minute.
This particular piece is a fishing jig that we're making for a prototype of multiple fishing jigs that can be produced. On this bed, we can produce about 250 units a night with this technology, and it's using UV lighting to actually cure the material immediately so it's non-toxic and we can pick it up at the end of its growth.
So that little object right there is what is being built up right there.
Right.
Okay, so and that will grow over the next few minutes, and we'll check back in with that. Let's go let this system do it's a little bit noisy, so let's go and talk a little bit more about 3D printing and the work that you do here at your studio with it, and we'll check back in with the finished product.
Terrific.
Okay, Mark, you've led us down a couple of floors down to your construction studio, down a couple floors from where the 3D printer is. Tell us now a little bit about what you do. You call it custom fabrication. You've been doing this for almost three decades. Tell us how the 3D printer fits into your overall business and custom fabrication.
Well, it's a natural evolution to what we were doing originally with custom design jewelry. The skill sets for fabricating jewelry, it turns out, are very similar to science in biomedical, physics, even studio arts. So we apply the same discipline, a different scale, as any contractor of any manufacturing environment. What we decided to do that's unusual is turn a jewelry store into prototyping and proof of concept and additional production pieces in the scale of a piece of jewelry, basically an 8-inch cube or smaller, and start manufacturing on a scale of more of a boutique manufacturing space.
So what I hear you saying is any object, three-dimensional object that I can fit into an 8-inch cube, you can replicate, and I can choose the material.
For the most part, you can choose photopolymers, which can run from hard to soft, ABS plastic to silicone type of material. You can choose stainless, platinum, gold, silver, bronze, aluminums, brasses, those kind of materials, woods, styrofoams. What we don't work in as far as casting or machining is titanium or tungsten. We do work in titanium welding.
Okay. So tell me some of the applications, some of the things I see in various areas, in some showcases you have around your facility here, things that you've made. What is the length and breadth of the type of applications that 3D printing can be used for that you have used it for?
It's unlimited. You know, we can make with the type of bed that we have upstairs, and I said it 8-inch cube, but the bed we have upstairs is a 14-square-inch X and Y and 8-inch Z. So we can build cubes 14 inches by 14 inches by 8 inches. I could build a nuclear destroyer as a prototype, something for illustration, just, you know, 14 square inches by 8 inches deep at a time. So, you know, scale is not limiting, you know, only to the fact that our building blocks are relatively small. But we can build prototypes of homes, of new construction, of medical devices, medical implants, pieces of jewelry, vases.
In fact, you have worked with the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, I understand. For example, what have you made in conjunction with them?
We've worked with them on several different modeling. One was we've made forms of tracheas for training and surgery. We've made vessel sets from the carotid artery up to the optic nerve for aneurysm studies. We did a prototype and then actually constructed a one-to-one model of a portable toilet seat for a little girl with cerebral palsy. Right now we're working on an insect collection.
In fact, you've got that object right here in your construction studio. Tell us about it.
So we are working with experimentation in the ectoskeleton of the insects to see how well a vacated ectoskeleton will react in our casting or investing solution. Right now we have locusts, we have different types of beetles, we have wasps, we have flies, and they've already been dead for a while, so we did not kill them. No insects were harmed in this experiment. But we are playing with the skeleton to see how cleanly it burns out and see what kind of residual imprint it leaves in the investment so that we can cast it.
This is really amazing. We'll have to put an image of this on our website if we can, Mark, because what we've got here is the cicadas, other insects here that you're replicating in polymers, I guess, right here.
Right.
And somebody has a sense of humor. There's a little note that says, "What bugs you?" next to the collection. Is that you?
Yeah, it's my brother. I don't have the same kind of personality as he does. He's much funnier than me. But in any case, we have a lot of fun here. And the idea is to push the limit of experimentation. Nothing to say that we couldn't make a stud and cufflink set out of this, or a necklace, or a ring, or a tiara. So whether it's for research that goes into a museum, or whether it's for jewelry that goes into an intimate canvas, it doesn't matter to us. What matters is that we're able to construct something very specifically to a high degree of fabrication technique and the aesthetic and the skill set that's used.
It's very puzzling to people when you say, and I'm sure you've had this reaction, 3D printing. We always think that's flat. How in the world does this thing work?
So it does work very similarly to your printer, your paper printer at home. The only difference is instead of printing on a flat sheet, it prints on a flat bed that lies horizontal. The bed actually sinks into the machine. So as I layer, imagine a layer of ink. A layer of ink will actually grow thick if you keep on binding it to the next layer. So if I lay the layer of ink and then I put down some glue and lay the next layer of ink, you start beginning to grow depth to the object. And those concentric layers are much like a pearl growth, much like a tree growing, much like any three-dimensional object growing, except we're doing it in a synthetic environment where we're actually laying down the layers one layer at a time, 16 microns or 1.6 hundredths of a millimeter thick.
I love that, the idea that you said like a pearl, laying down layers. You're replicating often objects of nature, whether they're in our own body or bugs,
right.
But you're doing it as, in some cases, as nature did it as well in the case of a pearl.
Well, we're simulating the same experience, except instead of growing it concentrically, like a pearl grows, it's grown flat, although we can grow spherical objects. We could grow a ball upstairs, a golf ball, or a ball that you would, you know, a small super ball, or whatever we want, and a tennis ball. You know, what the limitation is the scale of the machine. But we can grow any organic object. The interesting thing about a printer is unlike a mill can only do sharp corners or rounded corners, and it can do an X and a Y and a Z and maybe a diagonal and perhaps something like a turntable, limited. But if we want to turn angles on top of themselves, if we want things coming inside out, you can do it in a printer environment, so it leaves you with an unlimited form as far as geometry goes. You can twist and you can turn, you can make a DNA model, and you can't mill those.
Okay, you've sold me. These are fascinating machines. I want one. What is it going to set me back, Mark?
If you have an extra $100,000 or $150,000 in your pocket, that'll work for the machine we have upstairs. The one we have downstairs, the machine upstairs, which is much larger, it's 1,000 pounds, it has a much larger capacity and faster production rate. Resolution is still quite high, where you get very clean models at the very end of the production. The printer we have downstairs is about $50,000. It resolves at about 0.02 millimeter, which means extremely clean. It uses a resin that is castable, which means that we can burn it out clean in the oven. It leaves no ash residue. So when we're casting, it is a completely clean environment, and it leaves us just the negative or the void space to put in whatever metal or plastic or rubber, whatever we want to put in as a final media.
If you've just joined us, this is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and on location for this interview, it's very exciting to be with Mark Ginsburg, owner and president of M.C. Ginsburg, Inc., M.C. Ginsburg Metal Arts Studio in Iowa City. He specializes in custom fabrication, and we're here because he's giving us a little demonstration of some exciting new technology, a 3D printer, replicating objects in three dimensions, which he's just been describing. And we're going to check in with a little demonstration that Mark has started for us in just a few minutes. But tell us, the machine you have, the system you have upstairs, you said about $150,000, is that unique in Iowa? Are there a lot of these across the country in Iowa? How unique?
The University of Iowa has several of these machines on campus. Studio Arts has two of the machines, and engineering program has one of the machines. A physics may actually have a printer, although I'm not sure. But in any case, not unique to research environments. What they are unique to is retail environments. You know, what we will see at some point is like a Zephyr printers or Kinko's or whomever, instead of printing in flat two-dimensional environments, you'll be able to go down with your invention or your prototyping and be able to have that done for you on the corner at the corner print shop. So we will be printing in three dimensions. As a matter of fact, on campus at the University of Iowa, we're actually working with printing cellular structures. So amazing to me is that in 15 or 20 years, we'll be printing from your stem cells, Ben. You'll be printing a replaceable heart, replaceable lung, replaceable liver, replaceable kidney, and it will be exact match to your own organs because we'll be using your stem cells.
Actually made out of tissue, living tissue.
Your tissue. Your tissue in three dimensions, your heart. God forbid something should happen to you and you need a new heart, you will not have to wait in line for a transplant. You'll just have to be able to afford it. And perhaps insurance will pay for that, but it'll be an exact match, and you'll be able to print it off on a printer at the University of Iowa hospitals and clinics. In another 20 years, I bet that will be real.
Well, if you're going to go that far, what about printing food? Can I print a banana?
They're working on taking the DNA of banana. They're working on taking chocolates and printing, instead of in ink, printing in chocolate, so you can print any form in chocolate. That's being done today. They're printing homes off of 18-foot or 18-wheel trucks. So you have a full-size construction truck, and it's printing in cement with rebar. So the rebar is the binder. It lays down the binder, and it prints in cement, and you have columns for a foundation structure. Those are being done today. There's printing in stainless steel. There's printing in aluminum. It's amazing how accelerated this area is becoming. Again, what's unusual for this state and for most retail businesses is they vertically think of themselves. You know, M.C. Ginsburg Jewelers is just a jeweler, therefore all I can do is jewelry. Well, we don't think like that. We're much more organic in the way we think. The skill sets, as I said earlier, still exist. And intersect with biomedical, science, medicine, physics, studio arts, so we can perform any function and make any object to the exacting specifications that our clients or we have on ourselves. And that's what we've decided to become, is a custom design house for one-offs.
You said this can be compared to the early days of Xerox, of a Kinko's, of a Zephyr printing, where we would go someplace to have things printed. Now we all have printers in our homes. Do you really think in the future that we will have all of us, many of us, have 3D printers at home? What will we use them for in everyday house use?
Well, assuming you have somebody in your home or you learn computer-aided design languages, and you can learn that at University of Iowa, you can learn it at Kirkwood, you can learn it at technical institutions, you can teach yourself. As long as you understand the modeling language, you can plug that into anything and make it. So if you were a toy maker, this is the brand new future Geppetto. So you want to make a toy, you can make a toy. You can make a puzzle. You can make anything you want. It's only limited to the skill set that you possess and the tools that are available to you. And there's a company called MakerBot out of New York that's actually producing limited numbers of small-scale printers that start around $700. So it's not hugely expensive.
So this could also be used just on a whim. Say I want a party gift. Somebody's having a birthday. I could bring them, who knows, I could have you come and scan my hand.
We could scan your hand. We could deconstruct your face so that we can make one faucet your left eye, one faucet or one handle your right eye, the faucet your nose, and the shower head your mouth. So if you want to do that, we can actually deconstruct your entire body. We can have keychains with your face on it. I don't know who would want that, but
you're right about that.
maybe your children. You could do anything you wanted, and I'm going to hand this to you because these are the materials that this particular printer we have upstairs. So you can see that you have a jelly-like silicone object. You have something as hard and transparent as an ABS-style plastic, but there are multiple opportunities and medias that we can bind together in a single machine, which gives us a lot of versatility. So we can do hard and soft tissue, for instance. We can do skull and muscle. We can do skull and fibrous membrane. The machine that we have upstairs was used to do the pre-gaming or preoperative surgery for the conjoined twins in Egypt. They printed the skulls. The surgeons and neurologists went through, and they actually held the exact skulls of these conjoined twins in their hand, where you couldn't do with a CT scan or an MR image or a PET scan. You can't hold that image and pregame the surgery. Here, for the first time, we're able to print your skull, your shoulder, your knee, your heart, and the surgeon can hold it in their hands and actually revolve it three-dimensionally, 360 degrees, and try to figure out how they're going to attack the surgery.
Products have been replicated for a long time, 3D objects. Now we have this new era of 3D printing. How were they made before in comparison?
You were using human labor, just like you would if you go to an architect and ask them to build a model of a building or a home or a piece of furniture. They were building that out of balsa wood or foam core or whatever material they were using. They were building it by hand. We can build it using the same skill sets and using the same computer-aided design modeling that they already made the architectural blueprint in. We have to finish some of the geometries, but we can take that model and we can produce it without necessarily using a human, just using a machine. So I can produce 5 or 6 of those in a week, or 10, perhaps, depending on the complexity of it, where they could only do one, or a half of one, or a quarter of one. So we have the leverage of the machine with the added benefit of the skill set of the human labor, but we're able to leverage 100 units with one human versus, you know, 100 human hours and, you know, taking that time. So I can be competitive with China at 30 cents a day and no bathroom breaks, but I'm using a much smaller labor force, highly skilled, but the leverage I'm using to accelerate the units is machinery.
But presumably the Chinese are going to have the same technology in the future that we do.
Yeah, they might, but they have 1.3 billion people to employ. So when you talk about the new paradigm for boutique manufacturing, all of a sudden you have students coming out of biomedical or studio arts or business, then instead of going to work for Rockwell or instead of going to work in a biomedical environment, they all of a sudden start working on their own manufacturing concerns relative to their skill sets and then intersecting those with skill sets that are completely disparate from what they learned. So again, you have a biomedical engineer in orthopedics who pairs with a MFA in sculpting, who pairs with somebody in finance or in accounting, and you've got a brand new manufacturing boutique business. And we can produce out of this space, 1,200 square feet, about 20,000 units a year. Imagine 10 of these in Iowa, or 100, or 1,000, and all of a sudden you begin producing the same kind of units as a China at a fraction of the cost. It's a reinvention of America.
You've gotten me very excited about the future, Mark Ginsburg. I'm wondering about how the near future is looking for our copy upstairs. Is it time to go back there? How long does a copy take?
Well, it depends on the complexity of the geometry. So in this case, we made something that was relatively simple so we could get it done in 20 to 30 minutes, and it may be done.
Okay, well, let's go have a look, could we?
Absolutely. Let's go up.
Okay, so Mark, we're in front of the printer. This time the hood of it is open, similar to a car hood, and you've got a little shovel there, and I see the object right there. Tell us, what's going on now?
So this is a segment of a jig that we're making for a fishing component, and you'll notice that it's got like a jelly-like exterior. This is got a binder on it that peels away, and without looking at the geometries, I'm trying to figure out exactly what it looks like, but it looks to me as if the entire piece, this is a portion of the jig right here, this is what we made, and once okay. We look at that, this will become a fishing lure, and you've seen fishing lures for pike or for walleye or for muskie. This will actually be the prototype of that fishing lure. So this will actually spin in water at some point, mm-hmm. once we finish assembling it. Mm-hmm. But this will be for illustration uses only, so that this particular fisherman or inventor can show this to a patent office and give them a three-dimensional model as opposed to a flat, two-dimensional architectural blueprint. This gives them an idea of actually how this will perform in reality.
Okay, so let's take another scenario, put a little story behind this fishing lure. Say this is my favorite lucky fishing lure from, I've had it for 10 years. I'm afraid it's going to break. I would like some copies of it. I can't find it anywhere else. I bring it to you, a retailer in 3D printing. A fishing lure like this, what is this going to cost me? If I want 10 of them, 10 okay. or 100 of them.
Well, the more you get, actually, if we can do it on a single run, the less expensive it will be. So here I split from being a pure retailer to being a production house, a manufacturer. So I have two different hats in a single building. On our bottom floor, we're retail. On our second floor, we're manufacturing. And in this particular case, once we design the model, just like an architect designing a blueprint, that model lives forever. This costs us about 70 or 60 cents a gram for the resin material and about 30 cents a gram for the binder material. So in this case, we might have about $120 wrapped up into this material. I think less, but somewhere between $50 and $120 without knowing how much material is in this piece. I can't tell you exactly, but it can be inexpensive. It can be expensive. Typically, for prototypes, we're printing it for the proof of concept or for the patent process. So we usually just print one. Far less expensive than a tool and die used to cost you, where you have a tool maker and somebody who makes the die, and that ranges between $15,000 and $20,000. We're looking at fractions of that, $100, $50, $500, $1,000, but still much less to produce something out of a photopolymer than getting a tool and die maker to make this up, what we historically used to do.
Well, this has been fascinating, Mark. Mark Ginsburg, owner and president of MC Ginsburg Jewelers in Iowa City, thank you for showing us around and making 3D printing something that we can understand. Thank you, Mark.
It's been my pleasure, Ben, and I appreciate you having me on.
Coming up, we'll find out about more unique Iowa businesses. After a short break, this is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Today, you're listening to an encore edition of the program. We thought it would be a good idea this hour to focus on innovative businesses in our area. Last half hour, we looked at a 3D printing operation in Iowa City, and you can see that operation. You can see the 3D printer if you go to our website in a little while. We'll have those photos up yet this afternoon. Also, that copy of an insect that was made with a 3D printer. Perhaps you know of a unique or interesting business innovator in your area. Well, let us know. Contact us anytime. Our email is river2river@iowapublicradio.org. And go to our website to hear this program or to look at those pictures of the 3D prints, iowapublicradio.org. Iowa is certainly known as a producer of all kinds of great food. Saltwater shrimp is not one of them. In just a moment, we'll talk with a new farmer of Pacific white shrimp in northwest Iowa. But first, when a Los Angeles film production company needed vintage wrapping paper for a scene in a movie about a talking teddy bear, the prop master got in touch with a stay-at-home mom in the suburbs of Omaha. Well, it's been a year and a half since Kim Brockie of La Vista, Nebraska, got that call. And it's been a few weeks since that movie, Ted, made its debut at the box office. Joining me now, Kim Brockie, owner of Sweet Vintage Wrapping Paper. It's a home business which sells reproductions of vintage paper. Kim, welcome to our program.
Well, thank you, Ben.
Let's start off with movie backstory. How did your wrapping paper get portrayed in the movie Ted?
You know, they called up. They said they were doing a search. They were looking for vintage wrap. And when they called me, they said, our movie's called Ted, and it's going to be coming out in about a year, and we're going to have a Christmas scene. We'd really like to use your reproduction gift wrap. And I said, my first response was, what kind of a movie is Ted? And they said, well, it's about a little boy and his teddy bear. It's written by Seth MacFarlane, who does Family Guy. Well, I had never heard of Seth MacFarlane or Family Guy, and so I said, oh, it sounds like a sweet story. Go ahead. So they bought $20 worth of gift wrap. And then later that night, I told my husband, I said, you know, a prop master called me. They're going to use the paper in a movie. And he said, well, what movie is it? And I told him, and he goes, Kim, I don't think you understand. This isn't going to be a cute little teddy bear and a cute little boy, because he had seen Family Guy before. And I said, we'll have to go see it when the movie comes out. So the first night it came out, my husband and I went and saw it, and we saw it right in the beginning at the Christmas scene, and it was pretty amazing to see it. And these people were just so wonderful on the phone, and they bought a whole $20 worth because they didn't need much to wrap the box. And it was very, very exciting, and it was surreal to see it on the movie screen.
Tell us, how did you get started in making vintage wrapping paper?
It's kind of strange. I used to be a high school history teacher, and so even when I was a little girl, I would collect old things. I liked old magazines, old paper, old cards, old postcards. And then when I graduated college and started teaching high school, I would bring those papers into the classroom, like when we would study the World War II unit, and I would bring in my old Life magazines, and the kids just loved it, and I loved it. And so then after we had our first baby, and I quit teaching to be home with her. And time just kind of went on, and I got really involved with the five kids then in their school here in Ralston. It's a small Catholic school. And we were going to be having a fundraiser about 3 years ago to raise money to purchase a new gym floor. And I was in charge of decorating, and my vision was to take packages and wrap them in vintage wrap and put them on the walls, because the school and the church were started in the 1950s. So we were celebrating that. And I just thought I could go on the internet and find reproduction gift wrap, because I could find the real thing, but it would usually be in little pieces and pretty badly creased up. And I couldn't find it anywhere, and I researched and researched, and then after a while I thought, there's got to be a market for this. I know I was looking for it, and nobody could fill that need. So I told my husband, I go, why don't I try doing this?
Mm-hmm. And how many years ago was that?
About it'll be 2 years ago, in a couple months.
So what sort of market is there, in fact, for that?
It's basically museums. They love it. Boutique gift shops, resorts, more of the kind of not so much mainstream, not like a Walgreens or a Walmart, but these mom and pop places, antique stores love it. Now I'm kind of getting attention from these different bloggers that love vintage stuff. Now they're writing about it, and in fact, there's a shoe company in England that makes vintage shoes, reproduction vintage shoes. And I had emailed them. I had a question about a pair of their shoes, and just in passing, I said, hey, I think you'd get a kick out of my paper. And they loved it so much that they posted it on their Facebook page over in London about my paper here in Nebraska. So it's just kind of funny how it touches people. And a lot of people love it because they said it reminds them of their grandma's house.
I saw that on the website that you have there, a paper just like grandma used.
Exactly.
Well, I guess, what is behind this yearning for vintage paper? You said you've had it since a very young age. Is there something deeper that you can describe that we like to see these figures of what skaters and old-time Christmases and cartoons?
Yeah, I think it's because people just yearn for that closeness. They like feeling connected. They like feeling safe. They like feeling just that warm kind of feeling. And I think a lot of people get that from these different cards and these different papers. And I think, you know, in the last 10 or so years since Tom Brokaw came out with his book of, you know, The Greatest Generation, there's been so much interest in the World War II generation and honoring them. And I know when I used to teach high school, I would tell my kids, my school kids, I'd say, you got to talk to your grandpa because grandpa isn't going to be around forever. And he's got wonderful things to teach you about what he did. And I think that people have come to realize how valuable those people were, that generation. And I think they associate that with their generation. And I just think people have a yearning for that.
Mm-hmm. You say on the website, all of our designs are actual reproductions from a private vintage retro collection.
Mm-hmm.
Does that involve royalties?
It involves doing a lot of dealing with copyright attorneys in the U.S. Copyright Office, dealing with public domain. It's very, very complicated. Mm-hmm. And it's a very, very long process. I did a trade show up in Minneapolis, and a woman was just asking me a bunch of questions, and she said, well, my daughter wants to do this. And I said, well, good luck, because she's going to have to invest a lot of money in researching this. So it's not just something where one morning I woke up and said, oh, this is what I'm going to do.
Right.
It took a lot of time, money, effort, and determination.
What is your most popular, describe the design of your most popular vintage paper.
Oh, you know, that's a really tough one. I just came out with a Scotty print that's a Christmas Scotty on one side from the 1930s and a kind of plaid jadeite Scotty all occasion on the other side. And that one has been a really, really big hit with just Scotty dog collectors. But I think, you know, really people love the baby wrap, the wedding wrap, the Christmas wrap. Everybody loves that. Crafters. I really couldn't say what's the most popular.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a personal favorite?
I do. I've really kind of gotten hooked on, there's one Christmas wrap that's got little red stars in it. It's very World War II, and I just think it's beautiful.
Okay, what next? Kim, you say 2 years old for your business.
Yes.
What's next? Do you expand the line? Do you stay with wrapping paper?
You know, I'm starting to do some cards now, and those are going over well. I'm making little individual gift tags for packages. That seems to be going well. I've had a couple of I had a sales rep who kind of approached me and said, you know, really, you should be thinking about expanding this into fabric, selling yard goods. You know, and these are all wonderful and great ideas, but it takes an investment of money. And with five children, you know, we have to be very slow in our approach, how we handle this. So as for right now, I'm just going to be staying in this whole paper realm, and then we'll see where it takes us.
This is a home business for you, Kim. You live just outside of Omaha.
Mm-hmm.
But to be clear, the paper is not manufactured in your home. Where is it manufactured?
It's manufactured at a great printing company called Barnhart Press, downtown Omaha. And they were the only guys that would try my idea. I got out the phone book one day in the Yellow Pages, looked at printing companies. And every time I would talk to somebody from a printing company, they'd say, I'd tell them what my idea was and trying to, you know, have them help me figure out how I can put this to paper, and nobody was interested. And probably by the ninth phone call, you know, it was getting kind of depressing. And then I called these guys, and they said, well, let's get a sales rep on the phone. And this guy with a very gruff voice answered the phone, and we hit it off great. And John has just been fantastic, and I just appreciate so much that Barnhart did this for me.
Great that it's so many paper products produced overseas. It's so nice that this is made in the United States of America. That would have been a good tip you could have delivered to the organizers of the U.S. team in the Olympics about their uniforms, you think?
Well, absolutely. And that was one of my drives was that it had to be American made because I just refused to do anything overseas. And so when I could find even a local company, and that's why it's not in big rolls. If I wanted to do big rolls, I would have to go to China, and I won't do that. And so that's why it's packaged in flat sheets. And people are really loving that it's made in the U.S.
Okay. Thank you, Kim Brocky, for joining us from La Vista, Nebraska, owner of Sweet Vintage Wrapping Paper. Kim, thank you so much.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we're exploring innovative businesses in our area. Finally, today, Iowa, of course, certainly known as a producer of all kinds of great food. Saltwater shrimp? No, that's not one of them. Or is it? Several weeks ago, my next guest sold his first batch of Pacific white shrimp. The shrimp were raised far from the Pacific Ocean on a family farm, the family farm of Chad and Keeley Duttler. That's near the town of Holstein in Cherokee County in northwest Iowa. Chad Duttler joins us for the remainder of the hour. Good afternoon to you, Chad.
Good afternoon to you.
How did you start this business? It's called Shrimp 59 LLC. You can find it at shrimp59.com. How in the heck did you get the idea to start with saltwater shrimp in the middle of Iowa?
Well, I did a lot of research on some different ideas. First, I was looking into the vegetable and fish side of things, and it just kind of led me to look at a different area, and I looked into the shrimp area, and that's where it's led me today.
Mm-hmm. Are there other shrimp farms in Iowa?
There's none to speak of. I think I'm the eighth one in the United States as an indoor, kind of all-natural shrimping operation. There is a lot of outdoor, you know, shrimping.
Okay, so yours is all indoor. Of course, with Iowa winters, we would want those little guys to grow up indoors. What does it look like in a large shed?
Yeah, the shed is 46 feet wide by 176 foot long. I started with half the building. Right now, I have right at I think 12 tanks going right now. And, you know, look to expand in the future if things go well yet.
How big are these tanks?
I have started out with 18-foot by 4-foot deep pools. Since then, I've gone to a few smaller 12 by 36-inch pools. I think I'm going to convert all over to the 12 by 36 in the future.
So these are small swimming pools you have in this shed?
Yeah, they're small swimming pools that they're being raised in, right around 4,000 per pool.
Mm-hmm. How many shrimp do you have on hand right now?
Currently, we have a little over 100,000 shrimp in the tanks right now as we speak. We did get a new batch in a week ago Friday, so we are starting them out there right at, 10 days old, so.
Mm-hmm. Describe how you raised them from the beginning, because you've only started raising them, in February, after you did a massive amount of research. Your first shrimp came from where? Did they come as, is it larvae?
No, I get them as either 9 to 11 days old. It depends on the company. They come out of Florida. Shrimp Improvement Systems are raised in an all SPF-free building, disease-free building. They are shipped to me overnight, and I pick them up at the local FedEx store.
Mm-hmm. How small are baby shrimp then?
They vary, maybe a 16th. Of an inch, you know, to get a small ant.
Mm. What do they eat?
I get a shrimp food out of a company in Pennsylvania. We start them out on a liquid diet. We progress in about six different feed levels and just go up on microns on the feed. They're mini pellets is what they are. Mm-hmm. And the microns vary from 400 all the way up to a 1,200 micron pellet.
Are they also reproducing in these tanks?
I don't keep them around long enough to reproduce. They're not old enough, so I don't reproduce right now.
You are a farmer also who raises cattle, I understand.
Yeah, I do have a cow-calf herd as well with my dad.
How is this?
We run about 60 of them.
How is this different than raising cattle?
It's nice in the winter. It isn't cold outside. You know, in the summer here, it's warm inside the building. It's time-wise, it's like calving. It's a lot of work when you get nurseries in. A lot of work to watch calves too. So,
right. I suppose, especially in this horrible time of drought, and I don't know how bad it is in your particular area, but it's nice to be a farmer where you can, for a change, control all the inputs, which you can, right?
Yeah, we can control everything in there right now, as far as temperature and what have you in there.
What have you found to be the biggest challenges in this startup phase, starting your business, Shrimp 59, of saltwater shrimp raised in Iowa?
The biggest challenges starting out is the water quality. Not meaning the water quality is coming out of my well. The water was tested. It's the water quality to make these shrimp as close as they're all natural as I can. And that means it takes a little bit to get that water in condition, and it roughly takes around 62 to 65 days to get that water in condition. So your first two batches to three batches that come in, you do have a higher depth loss just to make this system work. With it, we don't add any chemicals, nothing to the water.
A higher, did you say depth loss?
Yeah, it'd be a higher depth loss your first two turns to,
okay,
to get this water to, from the cycle of the food to them eating to their retaining it back out.
How do you, it seems like one of the challenges would, you're talking about water quality. Now, you have your cattle, they their waste goes on the ground, out in the fields. What happens with the waste of a shrimp? Doesn't that foul the water?
The waste of the shrimp is recycled back in through, I have a holding tank. It's recycled back through, and a natural bacteria with the use of an air stone will deteriorate. Natural bacteria will eat that waste, and it recycles the water and goes back into them tanks. We never waste any water. We recycle from the nursery water into the finishing water. Never waste. We try to not spill any water because we do have a lot, you know, invested in salt into these tanks.
Mm-hmm. You say you have these tanks in your shed there at your shrimp farm. What do shrimp spend their time doing?
Well, a lot of the shrimp, they are moving around nonstop.
Are they at the surface, or like it'd be at the bottom, or do they go up and down? What do they do?
They are all over. They don't necessarily stay on the bottom. They are top, you know, dwellers. You'll see them swimming around on the top side of the tank. What we have noticed, you know, since we've started is the turning off and on of the lights spooks them. Nets going into the tanks, we can get shrimp to jump pretty good. So we got to be careful with certain things like that.
Hmm. How big do these shrimp get? These are Pacific white shrimp.
Right now, we're looking at selling them around the 20 to 25 gram air. We have had them as big as 36 grams. Sold them out the door. So it's, to get a rough idea, that's around 22 to 23 count per pound.
Mm-hmm. How do they taste?
They taste, sweet. They are very, very tender.
Because I imagine there were a lot of different species of shrimp to choose from when you were doing your research.
Yes, there is. There's a lot of different shrimp to choose from. But, you know, this is the one of the better quality of shrimp, tasting shrimp, and just all around a good one.
Who is buying your shrimp?
Right now, just the local public is buying the shrimp, selling them all live. As of right now, we are.
Shrimp 59 is the name of your company. How do you see this developing, Chad, with you and your wife at the helm?
Well, we would like to. The building, like you said, is half full right now, and we see us ourselves expanding here within another year. You know, right now, as we see demand is well. So we see ourselves expanding.
Okay, yeah. Thank you very much. One final question: What's your favorite way to eat shrimp?
My favorite way. I've done it, you know, a couple different ways. I do like to grill. Grill them whole is probably my best way of having shrimp.
Chad Duttler, thank you for joining us for this portion of our program. Owner, along with his wife Keely, of Shrimp 59 LLC, shrimp raised near the town of Holstein in Cherokee County in northwest Iowa. Thank you, Chad.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Alex Hoyer and Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from Allison Sullivan. Technical support from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. Podcasting and on-demand audio of River to River available. Perhaps you heard part of this hour. You want to hear or go back and listen to it again. Shrimp, who would have thought? Go to iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.